Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is the song No One Else from Dave Malloy's electropop musical Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812. The musical is now on stage in an ART production at the Loeb Drama Center in Cambridge. And yes, Natasha and Pierre are the same Natasha and Pierre from Tolstoy's War and Peace. Dave Malloy based his electropop musical on a 70-page sliver of the Russian writer's masterful tome. But if a Tolstoy Broadway theater mashup makes even the lowest brow rise in askance, Dave Malloy has an answer for you about why he finds unusual adaptations so attractive.
Yeah, it's strange. You know, when I read War and Peace, actually before I was a proper musical theater composer, I was more of just a kind of freelance musician in those days, and I was working on a cruise ship, playing piano in the cruise ship band. But when I read this particular sliver of War and Peace, it's about a 70-page section about halfway through the book, I was just completely swept away by it and struck by how it had like the perfect structure of a Broadway musical. Like, it just kind of had that structure inherently in it.
So help walk me through this, though. What about it was the perfect structure? Because I have to say I'm not quite familiar with what would turn it so quickly into a musical.
Sure. I mean, there was just the intense narrative drive of it. Like, yeah. You see this young woman, like, you know, just fall so quickly from, like, she's like the most glorious, you know, perfect, wonderful person in Russia at the time. And she's engaged to the perfect man and he's off fighting the war. And then she just falls so quickly. And it's just like watching her go through this emotional roller coaster is just stunning and heartbreaking. And then in parallel, there's this second story, kind of like the B story, you know, in musical theater terms. And this B story, interestingly, is not another love story, but instead it's a story of this man, Pierre, and his kind of existential midlife crisis.
So you're reading War and Peace while at sea on a cruise ship.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is just a delightful image in my head. And you play one of the parts in the production.
I did. In the original production. Yeah. So and then I was on the cruise ship and feeling very kind of socially awkward. I just didn't really fit in socially on the cruise ship. So I really identified with the character of Pierre, who is this character going through this kind of existential midlife crisis and who is just a very socially awkward kind of sad clown sort of figure.
Well, there is a song in the show where you as Pierre, describe that state of existence. Mm-hmm. So let's listen.
I drink too much. Right now, my friend fights and bleeds, and I sit at home and read hours at a time, hours at my screen.
So Dave Malloy, a couple things going on there. First of all, it's just the sound of that song. Not exactly the sound that one would associate with a traditional treatment of Tolstoy.
That song in particular was kind of inspired by Arcade Fire. I was listening to a lot of them at the time of writing that song. And yeah, again, one of the things I was so struck by in reading the novel was like how much like angst these characters have. And a lot of that angst just reminded me of the lyrics of a lot of like contemporary indie rock.
The wind is blowing all the ashes around.
So a lot of Pierre's music kind of has this kind of Arcade Fire sort of epic indie rock feel behind it.
Yeah. And also in there I heard the reference to a screen, which I don't imagine at all. Well, I know it
totally.
Wasn't in the original.
Was not in the original. Yeah. So the song has, and the production rather, has a lot of anachronistic touches. So it very much is a bunch of 21st century performers putting on this show. It's also the experience that I have when I read those kind of novels. Like when I read War and Peace, I am reading it as a 21st century reader. So I'm always, you know, I'm not reading it the same way someone contemporary with Tolstoy read it. Like, I'm like, oh, this is a strange turn of phrase here. Oh, what a curious custom this is, you know. So I like highlighting those things in the show.
Also, in fact, I mean, the music And the modern field of music really serves a purpose in the show, too, because it's an electro-pop musical. Mm-hmm. It's been described as that. And in fact, like the real electric feel of the music starts when Anatole enters the story.
Yeah, yeah. And so the way the show is structured, the first seven songs are all acoustic. So the first seven songs, it's just, you know, the orchestra, which is cellos, viola, oboe, clarinet. And then Anatole enters in the middle of the seventh song. And when he enters, it's the first time that we hear these kind of techno songs. So there's a big bass drop when that happens and the subwoofers kick in.
An exceptionally handsome man walked in with a confident yet courteous air.
Because literally what he's doing is he's electrifying Natasha. Like, he's kind of awakening her sexuality. And so, yeah, it was this kind of wonderful dramaturgical coincidence I found as I was writing the pieces, because I didn't think of that immediately. But as I was writing, I was like, oh, all the electronic music seems to be happening when Anatole's around. And I was like, oh! Yeah, so it was a nice way to kind of justify that dramaturgically. Yeah.
And in fact, in the ART's production, everyone who comes will be literally sort of immersed in the experience of the show. Like, the entire theater is being transformed, right?
Yeah, yeah. So the show kind of, we turned the theater into essentially a Russian supper club or a Russian nightclub. So there's vodka being served throughout. There's tables, there's banquettes, and the action kind of happens all around you. There's no really stage per se. There's kind of a stage that is, you know, yeah, that the audience is completely immersed around.
Well, Dave Malloy is a musician and composer. An ART production of his musical, Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812, will be at the Loeb Drama Center in Cambridge through January 3rd. For more information, you can go to our website, radioboston.org. Dave Malloy, always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Pleasure.
And the end of the world. But for me, the comet brings no fear. No, I gaze joyfully, and this bright star.
So it's early December, and in just a few weeks, lots of kids will exit the classroom and take a winter break. Look out, parents. But not all kids. Some families have opted for what's called unschooling, learning through exploring and doing. Writer Ben Hewitt spoke with Radio Boston's Anthony Brooks last year to tell us about what that means for his two boys. And it's the subject of his book, Homegrown: Adventures in Parenting Off the Beaten Path, Unschooling, and Reconnecting with the Natural World. And Hewitt started off by describing a typical day.
You know, our lives are really dictated in many ways by season because we live pretty close to the land. We have a small farm. You know, every day starts with chores. After chores, we will have breakfast as a family. The boys will often spend, you know, as much as a couple to a few hours reading, and then we will have lunch. Usually in the afternoon, there is some project, be it something that the kids are working on their own or with friends. We happen to live in a community with a fairly high population of home/unschoolers, so there are a lot of other children for them to work on projects with. They have a part-time job working at a local dairy farm, so often in the evening they'll go down and do evening chores, family dinner, family read time, and bed.
You know, I can imagine someone listening to this and sounds like a vacation in the country.
Yeah, I can understand how someone could think that, I guess. You know, and you know, I have to say, we feel, we work really hard.
Yeah.
You know, I say that because I really want to make that clear. Like, this is not about just sort of like shoving our kids out the door or giving them total autonomy over their days or letting them do whatever they want whenever they want.
Yeah.
So there is, you know, we do work really hard, but a lot of it is of our own choosing. And so in that regard, I suppose it could sound a little bit like a vacation. You know, that said, I mean, you know, the kids have, I would say in some regards, many more responsibilities than a lot of contemporary schooled children in regards to, you know, their duties around home and farm.
Sure. Well, you know, when I read this, Ben, I'm a parent. I've got kids. They're in school, so I guess they're schooled. But, you know, I admire you. And yet I also, you know, when I think about taking something like this on myself, I'm sort of not horrified about what you did with your kids, but just horrified by the idea of taking on this responsibility, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, what thought does that provoke in you when I say that?
Well, you're not exactly asking this question, but you're asking a version of this question, which is a lot of people say, like, where do you get the confidence to do this?
I think that is what I'm asking.
And I think it's a really important question, and I guess I've often sort of puzzled that. I mean, I haven't always felt as confident as I do now. That confidence is sort of – my confidence has evolved over the years to the point where I do feel extremely confident, you know, that not only that we're doing the right thing by our children, but that, B, that, you know, we're providing them with the tools they're going to need no matter which sort of path they choose in life, be that a more, you know, traditional career or a more sort of land-based existence like we have chosen. I think one of the reasons that we sort of culturally speaking lack that sort of confidence is that most of us as adults were sort of placed into a compulsory educational environment. Mm-hmm. And so that the only thing that we can imagine ourselves is that a child's education, you know, must sort of be this hierarchical thing that is sort of taught to them. It's very difficult for us to get out of that frame of mind where we can actually imagine that, hey, you know what? Children learn. And that in some ways, it's, you know, the best way to stop them from learning is to try and force them to learn.
Well, this, of course, comes from your own experience. And I know that you didn't write this book to sort of bash schools necessarily, but you're the son of college educated parents. You hated conventional schools. And in fact, you dropped out of high school at the age of 16. And you wrote in the Outside Magazine piece that you published last November, the windows at your school, for all their transparency, felt like the bars of a prison cell.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite a line. What was it about your schooling experience that made you feel that way?
Well, let's just, you know, there's actually a gentleman named Peter Gray who actually works and lives here in Boston, who's done a lot of writing on the subject of children and school and free play. And actually, he was sort of the one who sort of introduced me to the idea that.
So can I read a quote from him? Because
I guess
came from
So
here's an article from a quote from Peter Gray. Children are forced to attend school where they are stripped of most of their rights. The debate shouldn't be about whether school is prison, because unless you want to change the definition of prison, it is. School deliberately removes the environmental conditions that foster self-directed learning and natural curiosity. It is like locking a child in a closet. And we should say Peter Gray is a Boston College psychology professor who wrote in 2013 a book called Free to Learn, right?
Correct. Yeah. I do believe that for a high percentage of school-going children, I think they experience that same sense that I felt of, you know, sort of my time not belonging to me, of being sort of force-fed, being told what I must learn, how I must learn it, and when I must learn it, and feeling incredibly, you know, powerless as a result. So that's one of the things that I really remember, you know, and even sitting here talking about it, you know, I can sort of feel that emotion like rising in me, that sense of just, you know, absolute frustration, which then sort of, you know, boiled over into sort of anger and rebellion in my case. You know, a lot of kids are able, you know, so I think some kids can actually survive and thrive in that environment. But I've talked to an awful lot of adults, and I would even go so far to say as a majority of the adults that I've spoken with, you know, do not recall their school-going days favorably.
You know, I know this is a question that you must get again and again and again, but I'm going to ask it anyway. You know, you went to school, had the option to go to school, made the choice not to go to school. You're not giving your kids the choice of going to school.
Oh, my kids could go to school if they really wanted to.
Oh, they could.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I think this is sometimes another misperception of what, you know, that we're sort of living this isolationist life where our children are under lock and key, and, you know, they have no interest. They have absolutely no interest. Part of the reason that they have no interest is that my wife and I go to tremendous effort to facilitate opportunities for them that, you know, actually make school to them pale in comparison. You know, and that's another sort of misconception I hear a lot, which is that this is sort of the lazy parents' version of education. You know, that is emphatically not the case.
No, you know, I believe that it's not the lazy thing to do.
Well, I will say that, you know, when I talk about unschooling or immersion learning or whatever you want to call it. I'm talking about our version of
it.
You know, and one of the things I think that's so great about this model of education is that it can be a million different things to a million different families. So I'm talking about what it is for us. Now, that's the antithesis of a standardized, compulsory education that is really one thing to a million different families.
Well, let's take a couple of calls. We're talking to Ben Hewitt. He's author of Homegrown: Adventures in Parenting Off the Beaten Path, Unschooling and Reconnecting with a Natural World. Let's go to Simon, who's calling from Cambridge. Hi, Simon. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm a public school teacher in Cambridge Public Schools. I'm actually a music teacher, a string instrument teacher. And I have an enormous amount of admiration for what you're doing with your children. I think it does take a lot of confidence, a lot of effort. And I suppose my real question is, if you feel like your kids have the same opportunities as other kids in the country who have had a more traditional schooling, whilst I agree you're prepared to put in the same amount of effort, if not more, than regular school teachers, how do you get the intellectual and educational confidence, and what could you say to people wanting to follow your path that you have the kind of capacity to teach such a broad spectrum of subjects that is necessary for your kids to achieve?
Sure, Simon, thanks for putting that on the table. Ben, please.
Yeah, well, I guess, a couple things. And I want to talk a little more broadly about this whole subject of opportunity, because I hear that language a lot. You know, aren't you concerned about, for instance, this is not exactly what he's asking or what Simon is asking, although, again, I think he's sort of asking a version of this. Are you not concerned about the opportunities, or are your children not, being exposed to certain opportunities by not being in school? You know, the only honest answer to that is, of course, that's the case. Just as those children who are in school are not being exposed to certain opportunities that my children have, just like, every parent anywhere in the world can never expose their children to every opportunity the world has to offer them. We live in a really incredibly rich and diverse world with all sorts of amazing things to see and do and hear and experience. In terms of the diversity of subjects, one of the things and one of the very reasons that we sort of choose this style of education is because we actually believe that it exposes our children to a much broader range of subject matter. And more importantly, it does it in a way that feels very tangible to them. In the real world, subjects are not divided into segregated 40-minute blocks, where the bell rings and you run from math to English to science. In the real world, these things are commingling all the time all around us. In some ways, I struggle to talk about my children's learning in the context of subjects because it just doesn't look like that. And yet those subjects are in their lives every minute of their lives, if that makes any sense.
No, it does. You write so well in this book, and I just want to read one thing that you write. You write, "This is the dream I can't kick, although I sometimes wonder if it's not a selfish one. My boys will not chase the infinite possibilities of the world at large, but wherever they may be, they will instead continue to find fulfillment in the world at hand." I like that almost as a sort of Zen statement, but here's the question that poses in my mind, especially when I hear they will not chase the infinite possibilities of the world. I mean, say your boys are cut out to be, I don't know, an astrophysicist or an astronaut or something that really does require, kind of regimented by the book learning and institutional access and all of that. Will they get there if that's what they're cut out to be?
I fully believe that if that's what they're cut out to be and that's what they want to be, they will 100% get there. And one thing that did not make it into the book, but that I experienced over the course of writing the book and also reporting the article I wrote for Outside Magazine, was that I actually interviewed a fairly broad array of adults who had been unschooled.
Yeah.
And one thing that I found fascinating, I actually struggled to find one who hadn't gone on to college. I think I interviewed 14 in total, and of those 14, 13 had gone on to higher education. And their experience is talking about that. Every one of them was grateful for the experience. Every one of them felt also that it had given them an advantage as they chose to pursue that higher education, because at that point in their life, they had found a self-directed path. They knew what they wanted. They knew what they were going to college or university to get, and they were prepared to work really hard to get it.
Well, Ben Hewitt, it's such a pleasure talking to you about this. I want to just read one thing sort of toward the end of your book. You write, "Our son's unschooling has become our unschooling, and the freedom we have granted them to embrace learning is a freedom we have granted ourselves." So that's it's another line of questioning that we don't have time to get into, but I just wanted to sort of leave that thought there, this idea that you make a case that unschooling benefited your sons. It's also benefited you and your wife in a big way.
You know, we're really the ones who needed to be unschooled.
That was Ben Hewitt, author of Homegrown, Adventures in Parenting Off the Beaten Path, Unschooling and Reconnecting with the Natural World, speaking with Radio Boston's Anthony Brooks last year. Well, that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.